Hey friends, are you feeling down? Does the cost of everyday goods and services have you feeling the blues? You're not alone. Let's talk about depression. And by depression, we mean economic depression. Just like people, countries can get depressed too. I want to talk about what happens when America gets depressed. Unlike people, or myself more specifically, when America gets depressed, it doesn't order obscene amounts of late-night DoorDash and stay in its pajamas all week. When America goes through a depression, the economy tanks, farms fail, and darkness falls all over the land. At least that's what happened to America in the late 1830s. Everyone will remember the Great Depression of America 100 years later in the 1930s, where Dust Bowl droughts and post- and pre-war sentiments had everyone slinking around in their metaphorical PJs. But the Depression of the 1830s, known as the Panic of 1837, is lesser known and lesser thought about because it feels so far away. But for Mormons, it's actually a pretty formative time in our history. We talked about this a little in the Kirtland episode about the Panic of 1837, which resulted from many things, including a sharp rise in prices of just about everything, and it caused a Great Depression over the United States that would last several years, causing folks to go hungry, to lose jobs, and be generally pessimistic about everything. Mormons felt it too. Oh boy, did they ever, especially since they had one of the 343 failed banks in America, or anti-banks, depending on who you ask, hanging over their heads thanks to Kirtland shenanigans. People weren't only disenchanted by Mormon leadership after the failed Kirtland Bank or anti-bank or whatever the hell we're calling it. People suffered and suffered under a larger trend of economic disparity. How the Mormons responded to the crisis showed a real American spirit of stick-to-itiveness. Mormons were setting up municipal systems in the swamplands of Illinois, which meant setting up a government. A better government than they lived under in Ohio or Missouri. Maybe they could shirk the surrounding national economic crisis by building a better system than the one they inherited. Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners, from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
Let's take you back to 1800s America. This is a time when a newborn country is making its way in the Western world. End of the Napoleonic Wars brought revolution and profound change to the entire world. In the mid-19th century in the U.S., we were getting just a little too big for our britches. Territorial expansion grew as fast as evangelical revivalism. Economic growth expanded with democracy. America saw the spread of reform movements, social movements, labor movements, all sorts of movements. As cities spread and industry grew, it gave folks a little more time to think about human rights. The rights of black Africans who were enslaved, the status and role of white women in society, notice we said white women, the plight of the poor. A wave of social campaigns sought to address these issues leading to the antebellum period. All of these things and more shaped and changed the way people looked at harm, community, crime, and so much more. It's no surprise, then, that along with all this social and economic growth and development, America was also trying to figure out how to achieve justice through laws, courts, and leadership. During this century, American prisons were established, public schools came into existence, the U.S. would formally abolish slavery, reduce drinking, extend some rights to some women, and expand and expand. Hopefully you got a nap somewhere in there. That's a lot of work.
While solving problems for one group of people, these new reforms and laws would have unintended consequences for other groups as well. As this sort of Anglo expansion dotted the frontier, millions of indigenous folks already living for centuries on the land would be wiped out by violence, disease, starvation, and greed. As religious liberalism exploded around the country, causing white Americans to shun the harsh Calvinist doctrines that hurt the generations before them, ideas like free love and new conceptions of God became new dogmas. Remember the Cochranites from last time? The ones not responsible for Mormon polygamy? They're right in the middle of this evolution. To understand all of this large-scale shifting, all we need to do is focus on a community whose story is the perfect microcosm of a larger American story. The Mormons in Nauvoo, whose ambitious plans sought to build a kingdom of God in the western corner of Illinois, gives people a great glimpse into the large developments happening elsewhere.
Lindsay's right. Studying the history of Nauvoo during this time period can help you get a bigger sense of what was going on in the country writ large. Friend of the podcast, Ben Park, makes this exact point in his recent award-winning book on Nauvoo. What I've always found fascinating about this time period is that Nauvoo was a center of American spiritual and religious innovation. Joseph Smith started introducing a lot of new doctrines and theologies, many of which we've already talked about on the podcast, but that's not all he was experimenting with. Settling and renaming the municipality in Nauvoo gave the Mormons kind of an institutional power they had previously lacked, and this became a sort of blank canvas for Mormons. Here in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith began introducing new forms and conceptions of government.
Yes, life was hard for most Americans during this time. But as the great moral philosopher Justin Bieber once wisely said, life's a bitch, but sometimes it's all right. For Mormons in Nauvoo, setting up a charter and a government meant a new kind of optimism that had previously been unseen. Of course, Mormons felt wounded and persecuted by their treatment in Missouri and by their basic general hatred from literally any neighborhood Joseph Smith set foot in. But here in Nauvoo, there was a new hope. The government that the Mormons set up reflected that. Joseph Smith was a spiritual entrepreneur, remember that, one that had democratized God to the fellow saints. He took on the American dream and applied it to religion. I'm a God and you can be too. Now he had an opportunity to use that democracy to sort of store power.
Speaking of storing power, this is a good time to remind you to add power to your food storage supply. They didn't talk about this in Relief Society, I'm guessing, but it's a good tip.
No, we never got that tip in Relief Society. We don't store power in Relief Society.
Always, always keep a 5-year supply of municipal power in your 5-gallon drum in the basement. Next to the guns, of course.
Can you make the, can you turn them into brownies?
You can, but then you take over the world and it's...
when you become a militia.
If you get half a brownie, that's probably the recommended dose.
These are special brownies, but not the fun kind.
Not
these
those kind of special brownies.
Powerful kind of brownies.
And you're going to need that stored power just to get through this episode. Remember when he told you about the joys and thrills of meticulous legal arguments? Well, we finally convinced old Dr. Idaho himself, Brother John Dinger, to come and explain some of the legal innovations in Nauvoo. And it's interesting to think about this time being a new, optimistic period for Mormons, but it would be really short-lived. Remember, all of this lasts only about 5 or 6 years. But during that time, Mormons were innovating all sorts of things. And luckily for us, Dinger, an excellent legal scholar of Mormonism, has laid the groundwork for how the legal system in Nauvoo works.
Why does this matter? When I hear legal arguments in nearly any scenario, a little part of my soul dies and flies to be with my heavenly father. And the other part of me ignores the conversation to play classic Bejeweled on my phone. But don't do that today. Pay attention to Dinger here because what he says is actually really insightful. Your average person is probably familiar with the basic contours of the theology of Nauvoo, but the legal stuff? Different ballgame, my friends. He's going to explain the legal workings of Nauvoo. If you want to understand the history of any community, it's really essential to become familiar with the limitations around them. What laws were they adhering to? What laws were they not adhering to? Where was the center of their morality as dictated by their codified social system? In Nauvoo, it's even more interesting because the Mormons invented some of these laws. Why and what for? Who had access to power? Who didn't? If you can understand these things, you're going to have a better working knowledge of why Mormons did what they did and how they were able to do it.
So it's not without a lot of peer pressure and teasing that Dinger put down his bucket of milk, leaves the stanchion for a hot second, and tells us about the Nauvoo legal system. All agricultural Idaho jokes aside, Mr. John S. Dinger is an important voice in the Mormon history world. Let's give you a little bio of our friend so you can understand why he is so perfectly poised to tell us the story today. He's a graduate of the S.J. Quinney College of Law at the University of Utah, go Utes, where he was an editor of the Utah Law Review. So in addition to that JD, he also has degrees in political science and history from the University of Utah. Did I mention Go Utes? He's published in the Journal of Mormon History, John Whitmer Historical Journal, the Idaho Law Review, and the Utah Law Review. His book, The Nauvoo High Council and City Council Minutes, published by our pals at Signature Books, won the Best Documentary Book Award from the Mormon History Association and Best Book Award from the John Whitmer Historical Association. And deservedly so. It's very important. I've got it on the right side of my desk in a very convenient place because I pull it down all the time. In 2013, he also published significant textual changes in the Book of Mormon, which we have at a great deal at Benchmark, if that's of interest. Right now, he's presently a deputy prosecuting attorney for Ada County in Boise, and he's also a member of the Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force.
And without further ado, here is John Dinger.
This is John Dinger, super fan of the podcast. I'm an attorney in Idaho and a Mormon historian who focuses on Mormon legal history. You may also have heard me and Lindsay's podcast, Deseret Dramas, Season 1, where we talked about extra legal justice. Joseph Smith has always been credited with being an innovative person. Whether it was religion or marriage, he liked to innovate, but he was also somewhat innovative when it came to the law. So he did set up a legal system in Nauvoo that was unlike any of the others from cities around. It was a two-tiered system, but there was also a sort of third tier that functioned everywhere. So I'll say Nauvoo had a sort of three-tiered system, and again, it was unlike any other city. The first court tier would be the use of justices of the peace. The second tier was the mayor's court, and the final tier was the municipal court. Joseph Smith had absolute legal authority to set this up, by the way. We'll talk about that. He got his power from the Illinois legislature with the Nauvoo Charter. So the authority to create the mayor and municipal courts came from the Nauvoo Charter. In early 19th century, a city would not be able to govern itself without being given authority from the state legislature. So starting in the spring of 1837 with Chicago, the Illinois State Legislature started chartering cities with special acts passed by the legislature. And many other cities and towns were also chartered, including Springville, in early 1840. And the Springville Charter is important in the history of Nauvoo because the Nauvoo Charter used it as a template. In fact, historians have noted that more than 80% of its provisions closely followed other Illinois cities, mainly Springville. So on December 16, 1840, the Illinois State Legislature ratified the Nauvoo Charter, helping set up the Mormon capital. On October 4, 1840, John C. Bennett had been appointed to assist Joseph Smith in writing the Nauvoo Charter and urged the passage of said bill through the legislature. In December of that year, Bennett was present at the legislative session as a lobbyist for the church, where he gathered support for the charter from other prominent individuals. Both Stephen A. Douglas, the Secretary of State, and Sidney H. Douglas, a Whig senator and leader, supported the Nauvoo Charter. Both political parties, the Whigs and the Democrats, viewed the Mormons as a potential boon to their power, as they were sure to vote as a bloc. Bennett seemed to have perceived and exploited this fact. Illinois Governor Thomas Ford later wrote, quote, "He flattered both sides with the hope of Mormon favor, and both sides expected to receive their votes." And so, though the Nauvoo Charter was very similar to other charters, particularly Springville's, it was different in three important ways. The Nauvoo Charter included a right to create a university, a standing army, and an incredibly powerful municipal court. The municipal court was especially powerful because it allowed the granting of writs of habeas corpus. No other 19th century charter in Illinois had allowed this. The charter was specifically created to be broad and powerful. Smith wrote, quote, "The city charter of Nauvoo is my own plan and device. I concocted it for the salvation of the church, and on principles so broad that every honest man might dwell secure under its protective influence without distinction of sect or party." Close quote. So with the passage of the Nauvoo Charter, the city was then allowed to set up a government and elect a mayor, councilors, aldermen, and other city officials. They were also able to set up their court system. And so again, by the authority created through the Nauvoo Charter, the Nauvoo City Council passed many laws from the mundane to the very creative. So let's talk about that first peer, justices of the peace. So this was not something out of the ordinary. Every city had justices of the peace. Some states still have justices of the peace today. A justice of the peace is a sort of low-level judicial officer whose job it is to keep the peace. And so back in the 19th century Illinois, justices of the peace were elected and were sort of a judge/sheriff hybrid. We're incredibly lucky with the justice of the peace records that we have from Nauvoo. There's this amazing Illinois legal historian named Stacy Pratt McDermott, who wrote how spotty justice of the peace records are from back in that time. But we're lucky in Nauvoo to have a few examples of their docket books. We have Ebenezer Robinson's, Aaron Johnston's, Daniel H. Wells. We have many justice of the peace documents from Newell K. Whitney. And then we also have many entries in Joseph Smith's journals where he talks about his role as justice of the peace. As mayor, he was automatically a justice of the peace. So justices of the peace would mainly handle low-level crimes and civil matters. Anything too serious, and by too serious I mean civil cases where one would seek to recover more than $99, or criminal cases which were a felony, those would be sent to the district court in Carthage. And so I'll give an example of what a justice of the peace does, and hopefully anger some apologists at the same time. On August 1st, 1843, Joseph Smith appeared before Justice of the Peace, Newell K. Whitney, and pled guilty to assault. So yes, Joseph Smith committed a crime. I'm not sure why apologists are so hung up on this. On that date, Joseph Smith got into a fight, a physical fight, with Walter Bagby, the Hancock County tax collector. And William Clayton wrote all about this in his journal. And you should all know about William Clayton's journal, because Brian and Lindsay have done a couple of podcasts on that already. If you haven't listened, go back. But what he wrote was, PM went to the temple at 4 o'clock. Joseph and Bakenstos came up to the temple. Joseph began to tell me concerning a tax title, which Hamilton had on me of the city lots, he having got a sheriff's deed. Joseph told me to inquire of Bagby concerning it. While we were talking, Bagby came up, and Joseph asked him concerning it. He denied all knowledge of it. Joseph told him that he had always been ready to pay all taxes when called upon, and he did not think it good behavior to sell his lots when he was willing to pay taxes whenever called upon. Bagby said he had done more for Joseph than any other man in the county. Joseph reiterated that he had abused the citizens here and was always doing so. Bagby then told him he was a liar, at which Joseph got out of his buggy. When Bagby saw him get out, he ran to pick up a stone to throw, at which Joseph was so enraged that he followed him and struck him two or three times. Esquire Wells stepped between them and succeeded in getting them apart, and Joseph told him to assess a fine, and he was willing to pay it. Joseph rode down to Whitney's and got the fine assessed, and then returned to the political meeting. Bagby stayed a while, muttering that Joseph was a coward, etc. So because this was a low-level crime, Joseph went before a justice of the peace, pled guilty, was assessed a fine, and paid it. And so this was an example of what a justice of the peace would do. On more serious crimes, what they would do is oftentimes hold a little mini hearing and find probable cause or determine that there's enough evidence to send the felony to the district court. So an example of this would be the people of the state of Illinois versus Artis Greer, a case with a Mormon victim and a Mormon defendant.
My mother's helper, she had herself a baby. Didn't mean to drown it in the bath.
So on January 13th, 1842, 14-year-old Laura Demilla Gear appeared before Justice of the Peace Ebenezer Robinson to swear out a complaint of rape against her father, Artis Gear. She swore, quote, that sometime the month of April AD 1839, her father Artis Greer compelled her to submit to his lustful desires and had intercourse with her against her will and has repeated the same at sundry times since, threatening to punish her severely if she did not submit. Close quote. Now, while these crimes were not commonly reported in the 19th century, they were taken seriously at the time. At the previous term of the court, a convicted rapist was sentenced to 7 years confinement in the penitentiary. So this crime was especially atrocious because the child would have been 11 years old in 1839 when these sexual assaults and rapes started to occur, and also because he used the threat of punishment to manipulate the victim and accomplish the crime. So the Justice of the Peace issued a warrant on June 13, 1842, and on the following day, Gear was brought before the Justice of the Peace. That little mini hearing was held, and bail was set in the amount of $1,000, and then the case was sent up to the district court, the circuit court in Carthage. And so those are the sort of things that a justice peace would do. But again, these aren't anything that any city in Illinois or probably in the country would do. Now, the second tier is where we start to get innovative. The second tier is the mayor's court. And so the Nauvoo Mayor's Court was a court of general jurisdiction, meaning all cases arising under the city ordinances or arising under the laws of the state could begin in the mayor's court. And so this included criminal cases, which are a majority of what the mayor courts dealt with, but also civil cases like debts and torts. And so a case would originate by a party who would swear a complaint before the mayor's court detailing the nature of the case and what the defendant allegedly did. For example, in July of 1842, when the city of Nauvoo prosecuted Edwin Little in the mayor's court, a witness swore that, on the 21st day of July, Edwin Little did commit an assault and battery on his person by striking several blows with his fists and otherwise. So it's kind of similar. You could have gone to a justice of the peace and done this, or you could go to the mayor's court. And in this case, each individual chose to go to the mayor's court. So in a criminal case, the court would issue an arrest warrant, and in a civil case, the court would just summon somebody in, directing them to appear in court. And once before the court, the defendant would then be advised of the charges before him. Subpoenas would be issued to potential witnesses on both sides. So for example, again in this Edwin Little case, this assault and battery case in 1842, a warrant was executed by the constable to bring the defendant forward. And then once Little was in court, he, quote, upon hearing the charges against him, pleaded guilty, and the court fined him a sum of $5. If a defendant decided not to plead guilty, a trial would be held with the mayor determining innocence or guilt. And the mayor's court was a relatively busy court for a town like Nauvoo in the early 1840s. And so we have some good records at the Church History Library, the docket book of this. And so you can see that between October 1841 and February 1843, this period of 17 months, the mayor's court presided over 31 cases, in addition to other judicial functions such as issuing search warrants. And the cases brought before the court in this time period included assault and battery, disorderly conduct, false imprisonment, forcible detainer, larceny, violation of the ferryman ordinance, selling spirituous liquors, and then many civil debt actions. And as you know from previous podcasts, John C. Bennett was the mayor for a time, and so he presided over approximately 10 cases before he was discharged as the mayor in 1842. And the majority of the remaining cases were presided over by Joseph Smith. And I say the majority because when Smith was a party to a case, one of the aldermen would fill in. In a disorderly conduct case, Nauvoo v. Amos Davis, in December of 1842, Joseph Smith was called as a witness. So the parties agreed to have it tried before Alderman William Marks, who was the stake president. Also after the death of Joseph Smith, the new mayor, Daniel Spencer, would have presided over any cases brought before the court. Before I said that Joseph Smith was innovative, and this wasn't necessarily a bad thing, or wasn't always a bad thing. I think we can argue sometimes it was. My favorite case from the mayor's court was the Dana v. Brinks case, where Joseph Smith made a ruling that significantly expanded the rights of women in Nauvoo. And this was a medical malpractice case where Margaret Dana was injured by a doctor, William Brinks, in October of 1842. The injuries were serious and impaired Margaret's health for the rest of her life. And because of the common law doctrine of coverture, Charles Dana, Margaret's husband, had to file the suit in her behalf against Dr. Brinks, alleging that Dr. Brinks caused the injuries, misdiagnosed his wife's condition, used unjustified practices, and caused a premature birth. The case was tried in the Nauvoo Mayor's Court on March 2nd and 3rd, 1843. Now, I use the word coverture, which is important. In the mid-19th century, in the United States, marriage was not an equal partnership. A legal concept known as coverture, which originated in the English common law, was the law in most states in the United States, including Illinois, and so in Nauvoo during the Mormon era. And what coverture was that when a woman married, her legal identity then merged with that of her husband. So a married woman could not bring a lawsuit if she was injured. The suit had to be filed by her husband. In most cases, she couldn't even testify in trial as a party. Her husband would have to do that. She also could not independently enter into a contract or own property. And so this is why her husband had to bring the complaint and why it was the damage to her husband that were recoverable. Now, this was a highly contested trial. There were many witnesses on both sides, many midwives. Patty Bartlett Sessions was called. Doctors were called. There were fights between experts. It was just a fascinating trial for a little town in 1840. But what was most important in this trial was that Joseph Smith allowed Margaret Dana to testify, basically invalidating coverture. So the defense objected, stating that wherever the testimony of a person is inadmissible upon this ground, coverture, that of the wife or husband of such person should be rejected in consequence of the identity of interest created by the relationship of marriage, which is basically just a bunch of legal nonsense for the woman shouldn't be able to testify because she's not legally a person. So Joseph Smith rejected this, and he held that a wife may testify regarding an offense committed against her person when it is information to be expected within the knowledge of the wife. And he applied this to civil cases if the husband was a party. And this really was a new way of applying the law and had not commonly been done in courts of the day. And he ultimately held that, quote, a husband or a wife can be a competent witness where the injury has been committed upon the person of either, and where the testimony to be given is presumed to be beneficial for the public security and of general importance to guard individuals against imposition, close quote. And so this innovation was, I think, really significant and really neat. And those are the kind of things that would happen in the mayor's court. And so on to the third tier, the final tier, the municipal court. And this is the one that was most controversial. The municipal court served two main functions for the people of Nauvoo. First is, as we've kind of alluded to before, it was a court for appeals from any decision or judgment of the mayor or alderman arising under the city ordinances. So, for example, the Dana v. Brinks case was appealed to the municipal court. And second, it was a court in which people could request writs of habeas corpus. And so habeas corpus is a legal proceeding in which an individual being held in custody is able to contest the legality of that detainment. So the municipal court was to meet under three circumstances. It was to meet on the first Monday of every month, also at such times and places as may be prescribed by city ordinance, and the third one was any special meetings of which may at any time be called by the mayor or any two aldermen. And while these were the functions, or the main functions, the municipal court could also receive complaints and hear original non-appellate cases. So by November of 1841, just 9 months after the creation of the municipal court, the city council started expanding its power. It passed a law ordinance in relation to appeals, and this clarified that a petitioner appealing a judgment from the mayor's court, what they had to do. And it just kind of set out the rules by which they needed to do it. And like the mayor's court, the municipal court was also very busy. The existing docket book for the municipal court reveals that between March 1842 and January of 1845, the court decided at least 20 cases. And of those 20 cases, 8 were original cases or appeals, and the other 12 dealt with requests for a writ of habeas corpus. So one of the original cases, just to give you an example of the municipal court, was Francis M. Higbee versus the city of Nauvoo. And so in this case, Orson Pratt filed a complaint that Francis M. Higbee did absence himself from the city council without leave while in attendance as witness on the 5th of January, 1844, and of uttering and writing slanderous reports concerning some of the members of the said council since the aforesaid date. So a warrant was issued for the arrest of Francis Higbee, and the municipal court, consisting of Daniel H. Wells, George W. Harris, Samuel Bennett, Orson Spencer, and William Marks, convened. And Francis Higbee was arrested, but the case was dismissed when Higbee made satisfaction to the aggrieved party. And so appeals worked in a very similar way. In one case, John Grubb and John Ritchie were prosecuted and convicted in the mayor's court for breach of ordinance concerning spirituous liquors, and they were fined $75. However, they filed the appeal, and the following day, the fine was stayed pending the outcome of the appeal. And the appeal had to be heard when Joseph Smith wasn't involved in this one. It was Daniel Spencer as chief judge, so this was after the martyrdom. William Marks, Orson Spencer, George W. Harris, and Gustavus Hills were the other judicial officers. And so it was agreed by all parties to set the matter over to the March session. However, there's no record of the appeal happening, and that probably was due to the Mormons being forced out and the trouble that they were facing after the martyrdom. However, like I said, the most controversial role that the municipal court played directly leading to the death of Joseph Smith were the use of habeas corpus acts. So the habeas corpus acts passed in Nauvoo were so expansive that they allowed the Nauvoo Municipal Court to review not only the legality of the issuing of an arresting writ, like an arrest warrant, but also the underlying crime for the arrest regardless of the state in which it happened. So this allowed the Nauvoo Municipal Court to adjudicate all cases against Joseph Smith and other Mormon leaders on their terms and by Mormon or Mormon-friendly judges. And so this was usually viewed in one of two ways. First, it was seen as an example of Mormon unlawfulness and a disregard for the laws of the land. Or second, it was seen as Mormons doing what they had to do to protect themselves against religiously biased individuals that would do anything to put Mormonism down and arrest its leaders. And so, these habeas corpus acts in Nauvoo both protected the Mormons and alienated them from their non-Mormon neighbors. And again, this was one of the major complaints from those in Carthage and apostates that Joseph Smith was unarrestable, in which he would use these writs of habeas corpus. And so usually this dealt with the arrest warrants coming out of Missouri for the murder of Lynburn Boggs, or the attempted murder, And so what would happen is people from Missouri would come over with an arrest warrant. They'd arrest Joseph Smith. People from Nauvoo would then kind of circle all of them, get a writ of habeas corpus from the municipal court. They would then take the arresting officers and Joseph Smith to the municipal court, where the municipal court would then examine the arrest warrant, determine that it was not appropriate, and discharge Joseph Smith. And they did this multiple times. And so this was something that really infuriated the neighbors. And this also happened with the last and final time with the Nauvoo Expositor. So on June 7th, 1844, the first issue of the Nauvoo Expositor was published. And the paper's main purpose was stated in its prospectus, and it was to advocate through the columns of the Expositor the unconditional repeal of the Nauvoo City Charter, meaning that they wanted to do away with this court and the Habeas Corpus Acts. And so after the first issue was put into circulation, the Nauvoo City Council destroyed the press, declaring it to be a nuisance. So when the owners complained, Smith was arrested, but he again used a writ of habeas corpus that was issued by the municipal court to be tried in Nauvoo. So Daniel H. Wells, heading the municipal court, acquitted Joseph Smith of anything wrong with the destruction of the Nauvoo Charter on June 17th. And so you can imagine that this acquittal just outraged the non-Mormons in surrounding areas and throughout the state of Illinois in general. And they just felt that, again, this was an abuse of the court system, that Joseph Smith was having these writs issued on his home turf and dismissing any case brought against him. And so while both sides of this conflict started to prepare for, this upcoming battle, Governor Ford went to Carthage to defuse the situation. And so while there, he demanded that Smith come to Carthage and be tried for the crime again, this time by a non-Mormon judge. And a trial was never held because on the night of June 27th, a mob of men stormed the jail and murdered Joseph and Hiram Smith. And so the mob killed them in part because they believed it was the only way justice would be served as the municipal court kept blocking the arrest. And so that's the controversy of the municipal court. And so again, this is a fascinating subject, especially for legal nerds like myself. It's important because I think you see a lot of Joseph Smith's innovations in, again, religion, marriage, or law being replicated in other places that the saints went.
From the villages and farms and reds came the men, dirty and poor and thin. I shed my past.
What do you think about those apples, Brian? Are you satisfied? You've been harassing Dinger for months to come on the podcast, and now he's just given us this eloquent soliloquy on meticulous legal arguments of Nauvoo.
It's actually kind of fun because we slip in little references that we know he'll get, and then he gets them and he tells us about them.
So. I know, and all of our Idaho jokes are generally pointed in his direction.
It's Dinger Easter eggs. More importantly, he shows how Joseph Smith really was an American innovator, for better or for worse. I especially like how he discussed the three-tiered legal system. What is with Mormons and three tiers? Did you have to have a plural lawyer to get in the highest degree?
That's a solid joke. I like that. I feel like Tears of Three is a great name for a Mormon punk garage band, no?
Yeah, we know Mormons aren't using garages for punk bands. Those are used for Pinewood Derby projects.
Not anymore. We don't raise Boy Scouts these days, Brian. Ever since the LDS Church got rid of the scouting program, the Pinewood Derby died with it. It's very sad.
Honestly, right now, if you gave me a Pinewood Derby car and there was a track outside, I'd go race it. I got to do that once.
To give you a block of wood, let you whittle it.
I can still remember. I took second and I got a gift certificate to a store in the mall and I got a jazz hat with it.
Wow.
Your
scout leaders were...
Vividly remember this.
Knew what they were doing. You know what I vividly remember? My brother making his cool Pinewood Derby car, and I got to help spray paint it metallic blue and then watch as they walked out the door to go to scouts.
Ah, did girls not do Pinewood Derby?
We didn't. You know what we got to do? Make fashion shows out of toilet paper and paper plates. Aren't you jealous?
Equal? Separate but equal?
We weren't storing our power in our 5-gallon buckets, if that's what you mean.
But they did have lace on the buckets. Okay, hopefully we've given you an introduction to the legal side of things in Nauvoo with that. And this is going to be very important when we get in the later periods, because that's huge. I mean, it's important in Nauvoo, but it will be huge in Utah. But for now, you can see the rise and fall of Mormonism in Nauvoo, specifically in that legal system. And it's also interesting to think about how Mormons tie in theology with reactions to larger American movements like nationwide depressions. Plus, if you ever get attacked by Dracula, yelling habeas corpus 3 times, it's very effective.
I'm just glad Mormon response to a depression like this was to start an entire town rather than to spend money on DoorDash. Who am I to judge? At least Joseph Smith wasn't in bed eating Arby's at 2 a.m. and watching reruns of 30 Rock.
One day as I was closing my country music store, in came a red-haired lady.
Et vitae quoniam tempest est un ex libris referunt Mormons. Listen, it's a legal episode, and the Constitution requires me to introduce books of Mormons in Latin. It's just how it works. Now, here's the thing. There's not really a lot book-wise on legalese and Mormons. You have Sustaining the Law, Joseph Smith's Legal Encounters, which has some good articles. There has been some pushback on some of those articles. We talked earlier when we talked about the Lawrence Estate, and Johnny Stevenson, our departed friend, had a lot to say about that article. He pushed back.
What was
quite
his main
strongly.
Critique?
He did not like any of it.
Okay.
He talked about how the estate had been used as collateral, and despite claims to the state that the estate had been managed properly, he thought it had been pretty well embezzled and misused. So there's some pushback, but there are some good articles in there. For a more general overview, not just Joseph Smith's lifetime, you also have Zion in the Courts, A Legal History of the Church of Jesus Christ from 1830 to 1900, which is excellent. That's a very good overview.
Well, I know you're always itching for a place to use your Latin. Can you introduce the Sun Sun Symposium this year in Latin?
Caveat emptor? Ad hominem?
No, wrong. Well,
Tempus
maybe.
Fugit?
Yeah, okay, fair.
I tried.
This is just a reminder that this podcast is fueled by your donations, and we need them, and my Diet Coke habit also needs them. So give a donation to sunstone.org if you're enjoying what you're hearing, or even better, you can support us by coming to our annual Mecca, the Mormon Comic-Con, Sunstone, at the end of July, July 28th through the 31st this year in 2021. You can come to Sandy, Utah, and enjoy our conference. Brian and I will be there. If you are remote and can't make it to Utah, please register digitally. That helps give us a donation, and you have access to over 150 amazing presentations from scholars, poets, artists, historians, social thinkers, and therapists, and everything in between. The Sunstone's always a good time.
There's a trivia contest.
And Mormon, the Sunstone Mormon History Podcast is sponsoring a trivia contest on Saturday night. So we look forward to seeing you register at sunstone.org.
For my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young, a blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. 'Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young. Let only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young.
The song you you've heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by artist Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.